From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and senior reporter at Marketplace Nancy Marshall Genzer. Well, here are the issues. In the political swing state of Pennsylvania, President Biden presented his latest argument for Democrats to retain hold of Congress in upcoming midterm elections with combating crime and gun control, as the party's chances have increased in recent weeks. The president is promoting his Safer America agenda to Americans and his administration's policies surrounding support for law enforcement and crime. Biden also focused on America's democracy in a primetime speech. The U.S. Justice Department said it had evidence of likely efforts to obstruct the government's investigation of classified documents being held at Trump's Florida estate. The last leader of the former Soviet Union and winner of a Nobel Peace Prize, Mikhail Gorbachev, died at the age of 91 after a long illness. Analysts say Gorbachev leaves a mixed legacy by being more respected in other countries than at home. The International Atomic Energy Agency says a team is headed to Europe's largest nuclear power plant located in southern Ukraine. This will be the first such inspection team to be let in since Russian forces took over the complex in early March. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, President Biden took his 2022 midterm roadshow to Pennsylvania, a key battleground state, where he laid out his argument for Democrats to retain hold of Congress. So, Anita, what are some of the highlights so far of his appearances in Pennsylvania?
Well, the young man from Scranton, now the old man president, has been to Pennsylvania now twice in a week, which is a real sign that this midterm campaign is really kicking off. Some of the highlights of Tuesday's speech, just to start there, is he talked about his gun control policy and his hope to reinstitute the assault weapons ban, which expired in 2004. But then on Thursday, speaking in Philadelphia, he wanted to address kind of the soul of the nation and this idea that extremist forces within the United States, what Biden calls either the ultra-MAGA or semi-fascists, have kind of taken hold of the ideology on the far right or just on the right in general. And he obviously, of course, strenuously opposes this and believes that some of the values that we should stand for as Americans are things like not being racist, not discriminating against people, not using political violence. In the source material for this speech, this dates back to his opposition to the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. But of course, a lot has happened since 2017. And so, of course, January 6th is a notable event on this timeline and one that the president has brought up many times as an example of how polarized and how violently polarized America has become.
As Anita was saying, this is an important area for Biden. He's from Scranton in Northeast Pennsylvania. This weekend, he'll be in Wilkes-Barre, an area nearby, as will former President Trump. Pennsylvania is, of course, a key swing state. And there are some crucial elections in Pennsylvania for governor, Senate, and U.S. House. And of course, Biden would like to keep control of the House and Senate, and it appears Democrats have a better chance of doing that. So this is a crucial state, and both sides are there in person. It's interesting that Biden is going back to this theme of battle for the soul of the nation. You know, that was a theme of his campaign. He used that phrase in his opening video for his campaign. So it's a way of trying to really rally the nation with some very big themes.
The biggest of all, of course, is this is not who we are. This is the dominant message of this sort of line of thinking that Biden is pushing, that this is not who we are. We are not a country that believes that one race is superior. We are not a country that believes in systematically denying rights to any segment of society. And we are not a country that believes in political violence. But of course, there are people who believe in all of those things in the United States today, and some of them are running for office or have already been elected.
And Biden is going to be, when he is in Wilkes-Barre over the weekend, he's going to be talking about his plan to reduce gun violence, and he's hoping that that is on the top of voters' minds. One thing that the Democrats are coming up against, though, is that people are really thinking about inflation because that's something that's staring them in the face every day. when they drive past the gas station, they look at the price per gallon and see if it's been up or down. When they go to the grocery store, they see the price of food is up. I tried to buy pine nuts at Costco and they were $40. So I decided to buy walnuts instead. So President Biden is talking about these lofty themes and the battle for the soul of the nation, but he's up against some practical realities that could cause voters to swing against him.
And with this new legislation just recently signed into law, do you all see Democrats now being more energized going into midterm elections?
I think so. I mean, what the Democrats are calling the Inflation Reduction Act could actually help put a dent in inflation. It's going to keep subsidies for health care for people who buy health insurance on the government exchanges. It's going to continue subsidies for those, so that will keep health insurance down. But it can't really do much about rents, which are very high. So there is some inflation that's kind of what economists call sticky inflation that he can't do a lot about.
And moving to our next topic, the Justice Department said that classified documents were likely concealed and removed from former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate as part of an effort to obstruct the federal investigation into the discovery of the government records. So really, what does this mean for the investigation and even for former President Trump?
You know, it reminds me of that old cliche about a picture speaking a thousand words. The Justice Department in recent days released this rather stunning picture of just classified top secret documents just basically scattered all over the floor, which they're hoping to frame as irrefutable proof that former President Trump not only had these top secret documents, but he knew it. He knew he was not supposed to have them. And this is a big turn in this case. The evidence is kind of mounting on the side of law enforcement that whatever Donald Trump did here was probably in opposition to the law. You know, nobody is above the law in the United States. So this is a dramatic turn in this case. This is where we are right now. And of course, it needs to be noted that the former president maintains that he has done nothing wrong, that this was his right to have these presidential documents and to maintain them as he saw fit. But that is, of course, contested by the Justice Department. I just want to finally say that the White House is not touching this with a 10-foot pole. Every single time the press secretary is asked about this, she says, as I've said before, we're going to let the Justice Department do its work. So they're maintaining this position, and they're also strenuously maintaining that the president has not been briefed by DOJ, was not warned of the initial search in early August, and has not been given any inside information, because they're trying to counter Trump's claim that this is politically motivated and organized and orchestrated by the White House. That, they say, is completely not true.
The other interesting thing here is former President Trump keeps saying that he declassified these documents, but that's actually a moot point because under the possible crimes the Justice Department is investigating, it doesn't matter whether the documents were classified or not. The Justice Department is looking into charges of willful retention of national defense information, obstruction of a federal investigation, concealment or removal of government records. And those charges don't require that those documents were necessarily classified. But getting back to what Anita was saying about that picture, I was startled because it's not clear if that was sort of set up that way with the documents laid on the floor, or if that's how the FBI found them scattered on the floor that way. If they were, in fact, just lying on the floor, that would be really surprising.
I just want to clarify that Trump said, I believe, in one of his social media posts that the FBI came into his house and made a mess and threw documents on the floor. So he's maintaining that they're the ones who made that mess. But of course, with classified documents, with top secret information, it's not really enough to put it into a neat looking pile. There are actual protocols for keeping that kind of stuff around. You can't just stick it in a locked file cabinet and call it a day. You have to take extra precautions. So just having them out in the open air, full stop, or having them incorrectly filed is probably problematic for those who care about national security.
Yeah, whether they're scattered on the floor or sort of haphazardly stuck in cardboard boxes, I guess it doesn't really matter.
Yes, and also lawyers for the U.S. Justice Department and former President Donald Trump, they are due to appear at a hearing as a federal judge considers whether to appoint a special master to review materials the FBI seized from his Florida home. So looking at this request for a special master, what would be the importance of this particular person?
This is just a neutral third party who is going to make sure that the rights of, I don't want to say the accused, the rights of the target of this search are maintained in this, and that the FBI is not trampling on the rights of the person whose home they're searching. This is a request made by the Trump side to try to maintain their rights.
Although this kind of request is usually made earlier in the process, it's happening kind of late. But yeah, I mean, it could help to just make sure that former President Trump's rights are protected whenever the special master is appointed.
And how is this investigation affecting supporters of former President Trump?
I think both sides are trying to fundraise off of it. I don't know about you, Anita, but somehow my email address was made available to both Democratic and Republican political action committees, and I'm getting all kinds of emails pleading for money. Some of the emails connected to the raid on Mar-a-Lago. I imagine both sides are raising tremendous amounts of money from this.
Actually, I mean, the Trump PAC showed significant increases in the days after the search. So people are pouring in money, and these are hardcore supporters, allegedly grassroots supporters of Donald Trump. But, you know, I think it's debatable whether these are grassroots supporters or AstroTurf supporters, as in engineered supporters. But in any case, yeah, both sides are basically cashing in on this because this is such a compelling story with such huge consequences. Because, I mean, we haven't yet talked about what could possibly be in those documents, which is a terrifying thought. There's a reason that we don't want everybody in the United States to know, for example, how to build a nuclear weapon. And some of the most sensitive, dangerous things that the U.S. government holds, which I have no idea what they are, but I can only guess at, are things like equations, chemical formulas, and also algorithms that we might look at and not understand, but would be critical for building things that would eradicate humanity. So this is some dangerous stuff. And I think everybody knows it. And both sides are kind of harvesting that and trying to gin up support.
And also, these documents could also contain the identities of U.S. spies working in other countries. And I should add about those emails asking for political donations, I do not give political donations to anyone. So I deleted all those emails.
It's time now for a quick break. And later in our program, a team heads to southern Ukraine to assess the safety of Europe's largest nuclear plant that has been under Russian occupation. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voaafrica.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and senior reporter at Marketplace Nancy Marshall Genzer. The last leader of the former Soviet Union and winner of a Nobel Peace Prize, Mikhail Gorbachev, died at the age of 91. It is reported that by the nature of the regime he dismantled and the sheer number of people he freed, Gorbachev may have been the greatest liberator of all time. Your thoughts on his legacy?
People in the West lauded him. He won the Nobel Prize in 1990 for his leading role in ending the Cold War. But at home, a lot of people really hated and despised him. They faulted him for the breakup of the Soviet Union, which was not what he actually intended with his glasnost or openness policy. He just wanted to open up the Soviet Union and have a little more personal freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. But it just got beyond his control and the Soviet Union broke up and people hated him for that.
I just want to step back and say that isn't this always the case that we have leaders in our increasingly interconnected world who are seen differently outside than they are inside? People are saying this about Barack Obama, about Boris Johnson, about Cyril Ramaphosa, about Olaf Scholz, about Emmanuel Macron, about Pedro Sanchez of Spain. You go to, you know, a lot of these developed democracies and people at home have a very different view of their leader. I mean, to say nothing about Joe Biden, who is seen very differently overseas than he is in the United States. That's kind of a feature, not a bug, of the modern system of governance. Just going back to Gorbachev and his legacy, he was a transformative leader in a lot of ways. And it must be noted that he kind of shook up the moribund Soviet leadership. Before he came into power as Secretary General of the Soviet Union, the last three leaders, Brezhnev, Andropov, and Chernenko, had died in office. These were old dudes who were cronies of Stalin, who had presided over this kind of aging, creaking institution that was mired in conflict in Afghanistan, that was really struggling to keep up its enormous landmass, which at one point stretched from like the Baltic states all the way over to right near China. This was a huge landmass and a big management issue that was plagued with all sorts of corruption, mismanagement, and just the sheer size of the thing. How do you manage an institution that big? I think that the other word that Mikhail Gorbachev, or his perestroika, which is restructuring, and that's what he might actually be, in a much more boring way, remembered for, because he fundamentally restructured the Soviet Empire by letting go of parts of it. And I think this is encapsulated very nicely in, strangely enough, an ad that Gorbachev did for Pizza Hut in the late 90s, where Russians are talking about, you know, Gorbachev is terrible, Gorbachev was great, and they're debating over slices of pizza what he did for the Soviet people, for the Russian people. And at the end of the day, somebody says, well, we can now eat pizza. We now have Pizza Hut, thanks to Gorbachev. And then the camera pans to Gorbachev and his granddaughter, and they're eating a slice of Pizza Hut. He will be remembered more for the glasnost, but the perestroika was also a big engine of change in the Soviet Union.
And, you know, he was asked, would he do it all over again? He said, yes, indeed, and with more persistence and determination. So I think that he really believed in what he was trying to do, but he just realized that he could have done it better. It is very sad how he ended up being so unpopular and how now Russia is again becoming a lot more authoritarian and Western outlets like Pizza Hut are leaving. Although it looks like Pizza Hut is still operating in Russia, McDonald's has pulled out and lots of other huge Western corporations are leaving.
And one of the most iconic moments of modern U.S. history was when President Ronald Reagan went to Berlin and against the backdrop of the Brandenburg Gate, which had been defaced, and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Many people felt like that wasn't going to happen, but then he effectively did tear down that wall.
More accurately, what Gorbachev did was he just didn't fortify the wall, right? That was his position. He wasn't going to pour money into that side of the Eastern Bloc to keep the wall standing. So he didn't actually tear down the wall. He just watched it come down. It was much more of a passive action. But of course, as the leader of the Soviet state, he had the capacity, of course, or one imagined that he had the capacity to do more, and he chose not to. So he didn't tear down the wall. He just let it fall.
And, you know, the atmosphere in Central and Eastern Europe was so different then. I actually lived in Budapest, Hungary, in the early 90s, right after the wall came down. And there was so much optimism, so many Western companies operating in these Eastern Bloc countries, Burger King, Pizza Hut, big U.S. accounting firms had moved in. There really was this feeling of optimism and also a feeling like they would never go back to the way it was before the Berlin Wall came down.
Yes, and let's move on now to our last topic, where the International Atomic Energy Agency says a team is headed to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. Experts have made it clear that a potential disaster is imminent if shelling near the plant continues, something both the Russians and Ukrainians blame each other for. So this is a very precarious situation.
And the same morning that the nuclear inspectors were headed to the Zaporizhia plant, it was hit by more shells. And in the second time in 10 days, it had to activate its emergency diesel generators. And this is the big fear, that there would be a power failure. You know, nuclear power plants need electricity to keep their nuclear waste fuel rods cool. If you don't have cool fuel rods, if they overheat, then you have a meltdown. And this is terrifying because Zaporizhia is the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe.
And it's smack in the middle of the European landmass, and it has six reactors, which is absolutely huge. So Ukrainian projections say that if something were to happen, if there were to be either an explosion or a radiation leak, this could affect 13 countries in Europe, which is, you know, millions of people. I just want to stress that that is a Ukrainian government projection. Independent experts have said, well, it is possible but an actual explosion would require, you know, a sustained aerial bombing. And that seems a bit unlikely. And that also seems a bit foolish on the part of any government to intentionally do that. So what is possibly more likely, which is terrifying as well, is just some sort of radiation leak or an attack on spent fuel sites. The IAEA is saying this is a thoroughly avoidable situation. Earlier this week, VOA actually got an exclusive interview with an unidentified worker at the Zaporizhzhia plant who said that what they suspect the Russians are trying to do is reroute the power source and switch it from a Ukrainian power source to a Russian power source so that this can be fully in the Russian grid. Suffice to say that the workers there, they're Ukrainians. They're being paid in Ukrainian hryvnias. They are Ukrainian professionals. And if this were to happen, they would then switch over to the Russian gas and energy giant, and they would be paid in rubles and have to work under that management. And that is problematic, too, because at the end of the day, this is reliant on one resource that we all understand, which is people. The people are holding up the operations of this plant, and they're the ones who arguably need to be the most protected. The IAEA is very aware of that.
Anita, one thing that you were mentioning, the radiation leak, that would also be a big deal because Zaporizhzhia is right in the middle of some of Ukraine's best farmland where it produces the corn and the grain that the rest of the world relies on, that it's just started to export again. And if you have those lands contaminated, obviously you can't farm them. So that's a whole other aspect of this, is how could this affect Ukraine's exports of food to the rest of the world?
Yeah, so we just have to hope that no nuclear accidents will happen. And it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. Anita, I will start with you.
Sure. So for the last year in this beat on the White House, I've been covering the back and forth of the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. It's always one step forward, two steps back. And it reminds me a little bit of like the cha-cha. Forward, back. And I think the important thing to remember is we appear to be in the end stages of an agreement. But what's really important is that both sides are still dancing. Nobody's left the dance floor here. This is very important. They're still engaged. The big issue right now, of course, is that there's a dispute over whether investigators can look at suspicious sources of fissile material that have been found in Iran. I think what just needs to be remembered is that this is a very delicate process, and this is highly dependent on internal politics in Iran, which I don't think we ever give enough credence to when we look at these kind of things. The Ayatollah has to balance his own support and his own party and public support, what little he actually needs to continue governing, which is debatable, in making this deal and in making sure that Iran still saves face in any deal with the U.S. So maybe it's not a cha-cha, maybe it's a tango. It certainly feels like that. And so it weighs on my mind because the consequences of this deal falling apart are so dire.
Yes, and Nancy?
Gorbachev's death really brought back a lot of memories for me. As I mentioned, I lived in Budapest, Hungary, right after the wall fell in the early 90s, and I was editing and hosting a radio program called Central Europe Today that aired in Budapest, Prague, Warsaw, Tallinn, and Moscow. At the time, there was a vibrant free press in Hungary. I never gave a thought to what the Hungarian government would think of what I was writing and broadcasting. And now the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, has a chokehold on the press in Hungary. And as I understand it, there's almost no free press left there. And I find that really discouraging. It's like the country's done a complete reversal from what I lived through in the early 90s when there was so much hope and freedom. People were just very, very optimistic. And I worry about the Hungarians that I worked for. I've lost touch with them. I worry about how they're doing.
Yes, and we will end the show on those thoughts. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and senior reporter at Marketplace, Nancy Marshall-Genzer. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to visit us at voaafrica.com. Thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.